The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Countdown, countdown, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, here for News Dissector Radio, a weekly program reflecting the views of my blog on mediachannel.org, the News Dissector blog, also the perspectives of a filmmaker, author, blogger, writer, troublemaker, hopefully bringing you an independent news perspective with a background and a history that goes way back into the back to the 60s and beyond. So hopefully you'll join us here. If you want to join us on the phone, it's 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. That's a call-in, our call-in line, and of course it's free. Joining me today, as in weeks past, Sherry Welch, coming in from Atlanta, where she's been snowbound for the past week. Good morning, good afternoon, good day, Sherry.
Good afternoon, Danny, from Icelanta.
Icelanta. Well, you know, Sherry, we have another program today with some interesting people. We're going to be referencing the events in Arizona that everybody are talking about, but hopefully from a different perspective. Before we do, I wanted to just talk a little bit about the financial crisis that we're part of, the subject of my film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, and a book, companion book, The Crime of Our Time, talking about the financial crisis as a crime story. I just came back from the annual Jesse Jackson Wall Street project that held at the Midtown Hotel. He's been doing this for 14 years, trying to focus in on strategies for economic justice, to try to talk about the inclusion of minorities and not only in the opportunity area to get jobs, but also in the deal flow area, so that firms that are minority firms get to participate in some of the fees that are paid to make various deals. And this morning there was a panel discussion with three members of Congress. There was Charlie Rangel, who's been sort of out of the news since he was, you know, censured by the Congress. There was Yvonne Clark, who's a former New York City councilwoman. Now she's a congresswoman from Brooklyn, involved with particularly promoting opportunities and businesses for minorities and women, and John Conyers, who's been in the Congress for over 40 years from Detroit, former chairman of the Judiciary Committee, now the ranking minority member of the Judiciary Committee, of course, Reverend Jackson, discussing strategies of how to connect what's going on in Congress to what's going on in the communities. One of the big problems is people in the communities really don't know what their congressmen are doing. Most of the news about everything is all very partisan, very people yelling at each other. There isn't very much information about what actually is happening in Congress and how there's an attempt anyway to get legislation through that will do something about important issues like jobs, foreclosures, and the like. And that was what was discussed this morning. I was there and happy when John Conyers invited me to come testify in a hearing of some kind in Congress about these issues. You know, I asked him how many people from Wall Street are in jail. He's a Judiciary Committee, after all. He put up his fingers with a big zero. So Conyers is concerned about this. How much power he has really is not clear. It's certainly diminished since the elections. But there are members of Congress who can do something to bring more visibility to these issues, and I'm hoping that they will. Sherry, thoughts on that?
I think that it's beyond time to do it. It should have started back in September 16th of 2008. But didn't the Reverend also do something very interesting where he launched a program called Resumes for America?
Yeah, this is very interesting. He's asking people to send resumes to this email, resumes for America@mail.house.gov. And the idea is to post these resumes in the congressional record to put a human face and a human story on the unemployment crisis and really show how many talented people and resourceful people are desperate to find jobs, to be able to feed their families. There were some frightening statistics given with, you know, about the way in which the wealth of black communities has been savagely reduced, with people who are in the middle class now sort of in the poverty class, losing benefits, losing their homes, losing their hope. And this is an issue that we should be concerned about, particularly as we mark the celebration, if you will, or the acknowledgement of the Dr. King birthday tomorrow. Here in the U.S. of A, Jesse pointed out, he said, we don't need to celebrate Dr. King. We need to follow Dr. King. And that Dr. King, on his birthday, was really committed to a poor people's march and activism. So these issues of economic justice, of basically dealing with all the financial crime and the like, is something that all of these leaders think is very important. So you're listening to News Dissector Radio. I know Sherry told me, let the guests speak, don't talk so much, etc., and so forth. But you know, the reason why I do is because I have a lot to say, and I don't have that many outlets in America anyway to say it on. So stay tuned. News Dissector Radio, Progressive Radio Network.com.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express, and Visa, Morgan Stanley, too. In debt we trust.
That's the theme from my film, In Debt We Trust. I started with it today because my partner, Rory O'Connor, in Global Vision, sent me a news story which reported that an American Express company has sent an application for a credit card to a three-year-old, okay? And, you know, they've done in the past, sent them to dogs and cats and, you know, any addresses they can find. But this was to a three-year-old. It's particularly poignant because there will be credit cards for children very soon as these companies expand into every possible unserved market segment to make more money and to squeeze people even more. Joining me as our first guest this morning, David
Nywert.
Let's pronounce that properly, okay? A freelance journalist based in Seattle, the managing editor of the blog Crooks and Liars. His reportage for MSNBC.com on domestic terrorism won the National Press Club Award for Distinguished Online Journalism. He's also the author of The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right. So these are issues that are very timely right now. David, welcome back to News Dissector Radio. How does your work and your research, you think, connect in any way with the events in Arizona?
Well, unfortunately, I kind of predicted that we were going to be seeing horrific acts like this, horrific acts of violence, political violence. And the thing about it is that that it's really frustrating to me to sit and watch this dialogue go back and forth, and everybody's sort of dismissing this as political because the guy was mentally ill. It very clearly was a political act, and it was and it came out of, it's very much a reflection of the environment that exists in Arizona right now, which is this extreme animus towards anyone who dares to call themselves a Democrat, you know. And it very much is ties into the work that I've been focused on for the last several years, discussing right-wing extremist rhetoric and what its inevitable outcomes are going to be.
By the way, we are going to be joined later by Sarah Spieth, who's an activist and basically a native Tucsonian, that's a person from Tucson, Arizona, an expert in conflict resolution and peace building for a direct view from Tucson. Most of the people who have been interviewed there have been either the victims and their victim families or law enforcement officials or political officials, but not people who have been fighting for economic fairness and justice and conflict resolution. So we should have an interesting angle coming up on that particular aspect of the story. Now, you know, every time these incidents happen, it's always reduced to the sort of lone nut, the lone assassin, the person who, you know, you can never anticipate that they're going to do it, and yet these incidents keep happening. They don't seem to happen as much in other countries. There are some incidents of violence in schools in Germany and other places, but it doesn't seem to have the same resonance of people going mad, you know, publicly in the street, partly because they're armed with guns. They can do a lot of damage.
Well, it's true. I don't know. And I'm not really in the position where I want to compare it to other countries. All I know is, you know, but we should have our own standards for what we think is acceptable in this country. And, yeah, we've got this long list of isolated incidents that keeps mounting up. And we keep being told that, oh, these cases have nothing to do whatsoever with the rhetoric, this inflammatory, incendiary rhetoric we've been hearing just dolloped out onto the airwaves in the last several years.
So fascinating that Sarah Palin used the term blood libel to characterize all this. This is a term that used by the right of the right in Israel to really criticize all critics of Israel as anti-Semites and talk in terms of blood libel and biblical terms against Israel. And now this the same term has been invoked here to basically, say that all the criticism or all the questions being raised, all the concerns being raised are somehow totally illegitimate. What's Sherry about this?
I say that everyone should go get David's book and also go read his latest column. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because I thought it was very interesting, David, how you analyzed what was going on Fox News, particularly, you know, back you made a point that in 1870, after the Civil War, it was the bloody shirt, and how the right-wingers constantly portray themselves as victims. Would you care to comment about that?
Well, sure, yeah. Actually, and of course, I get this from a scholar named Stephen Budiansky, who does some great work and has written a great book called Bloody Shirt, Terror After Appomattox. And in it, he describes how, you know, the Reconstruction was, and essentially the verdict of the Civil War was functionally overturned in the South by what took place after the war, and particularly this campaign of extreme violence and domestic terrorism that was waged by old factions of the Ku Klux Klan and by the Ku Klux Klan itself, as well as the red shirts and various other racist factions, white supremacist factions, who in one case actually formed an army and descended upon an all black town where they actually had black governance, and destroyed the town and massacred a bunch of people.
It's
amazing stuff. And they were, the phrase that came out of this whole era was, you're waving the bloody shirt to even talk about this stuff, too. In other words, you're irresponsibly demagoguing. That's what waving the bloody shirt means, right? That's the phrase we all know, is waving the bloody shirt. You're irresponsibly demagoguing off of the blood of martyrs. And that's, of course, exactly what the right is doing now. After this, they're claiming that liberals are waving the bloody shirt, although they're not using that phrase. They've come up with this blood libel thing that was actually, Palin got that from a blogger named Glenn Reynolds, who wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal using that phrase. But at any rate, nobody really questioned it at the time, but as soon as Palin used it, it certainly raised a lot of eyebrows.
In a context here, there are several legitimate responses to what's going on being discussed. One, regulate guns and gun violence. The sale of Glock weapons and other guns actually has gone up since the shooting. And there are people in Congress who promoting the Brady Bill. Brady was the press secretary for Ronald Reagan, who was shot by a lone nut in Washington. And Brady was shot as well. And they're trying to push for gun control as an important issue. So that's one area. The other area is, calls for a sort of toning down of political confrontation and insightful language. Paul Krugman writes in the Times today, says, by all means, let's listen to each other more carefully. But what we'll discover, I fear, is how far apart we are. For the great divide in our politics isn't about pragmatic issues.
Yeah.
About which politics works best. It's about differences in those very moral imaginations that Mr. Obama urges us to expand. He says the real challenge we face is not how to resolve our differences, something that won't happen anytime soon, but how to keep the expression of those differences within bounds. And, this is, I think, a pretty interesting insight, because we are a very divided nation. We are divided about the causes of our problems and the solutions to our problems. But it is true that one side in this debate is far more prone to use language that incites, that promotes fear and the rest, which often creates a climate where people who otherwise might be restrained are not restrained. This was obviously somebody targeting a member of Congress. It wasn't just, sort of a, what am I going to do today? Let me go out and shoot some people at the Safeway.
And a Democrat. That gets overlooked a lot, that this woman was a Democrat,
David, you made in your proposal, you asked a question exactly how many left-wingers can you find out there who walk into churches, museums, political rallies, and shoot people in the head? That you go in, and why don't you talk a little bit about how many incidences since the Supreme Court passed that law since July of 2008, and then the rise that you can see it on the chart on that organization that Digby did, where since Glenn Beck became on Fox News, the incidences went from 2009 to 35 to 2010, 71.
Yeah.
I mean, these incidents are really compiled, And connected to each other. Usually, the idea of trying to create a pattern to point out a pattern of some kind of response, to see it escalate, is something that our media doesn't know. Doesn't do very well. Mostly, they connect, report each incident as a separate and discrete event. Many things happen at the local level, which don't get connected to events that touch off a national firestorm. In this case, the killing of the Congress person did that, but there have been other shootings in Arizona in connection with, like, the immigrant situation there where a young girl was killed, and it got no attention beyond Arizona.
But, yeah, David, in your research, how many left-wingers have you found that do these things?
I don't think that's useful, Sherry, personally, to make this just that way, because this guy, the right wing, is saying he was an anarchist. He was a pothead.
That's why I asked the question.
A pothead and the like. They're basically refusing to accept any connection between him and the Tea Party or the right wing.
Sure.
And so, once we get into this tit for tat stuff, what we have to see is that violence is very deeply rooted in our culture, and it's encouraged by the easy availability of assault weapons and guns, which, this particular weapon he used was outlawed until 2004, when the Republicans did not renew the assault weapons ban.
Yeah.
I didn't ask for a tit for tat, Danny. I asked because exactly what the point you just made. They're saying that he was a leftist, and they're also saying, and it's the left who are creating all this. And Town Hall magazine has the 50 most dangerous liberals in America. And then I don't remember the tagline that Susie Madrick had today on her blog, but it talked about there's only one way to get rid of them.
Well, clearly there's a lot of threats and there's a lot of kind of accusations going around, and people don't want to really deal with each other's arguments. They much rather demonize and delegitimize the people who criticize them. This seems to be a pattern in the partisan wars that we're all experiencing, where language, you know, that's sort of vicious is used, you know, and sometimes it's inverted. I mean, Bill O'Reilly, is pretty much of a master of how to do this. So I want Congressman King to investigate these Muslims, not because I'm anti-Muslim, not at all. It's just that, you know, I just like to get the information, as if this person has a reputation of getting information that's accurate and credible. I mean, he's serving a political goal and doing it, you know, the same way that the people targeted the big Ground Zero mosque. They were crazy about it. It was a news every single day until, you know, the issue was no longer deemed important and it was dropped.
So, David, what got you prompted in studying the rise of hate talk?
Well, a lot of it had to do with my work writing about domestic terrorism. And honestly, that's what I've tended to focus on even in this debate, is that this was clearly an act of domestic terrorism. We've unfortunately...
Let's just hear what makes it domestic terrorism.
Well, it was a political act. He was clearly and that's one of the defining aspects of terrorism, is that it's intended to affect politics, intended to have an effect on policy and politics and on the national discourse, right? And it's also intended to create fear in the population. And I think that this incident very clearly qualifies as a basic act of domestic terrorism.
You know, yeah, didn't two Arizona representatives just resign because they were scared?
Terror. What's that?
Didn't two Arizona representatives just resign because they're scared to be in politics
right.
now?
Well, not only that, the guy describes himself as a terrorist. Let's stipulate that. He put that up on his video. Okay.
Whoa.
So that was in one of his videos. So,
but what do you
I think clearly it was an act. What's that?
I said, what do you suggest that we do how do we start building bridges and have better conversations that are more effective than what Danny pointed out, this tit for tat?
Well, I do think we need to, I think there needs to be an honest conversation about the nature of our political discourse. And frankly, it's not going to stop until people on the right are willing to acknowledge that their adoption of extreme violent rhetoric has had a really toxic effect on our discourse, and that they're willing to stop doing it. It's just not going to happen. They're not going to do it until we're not going to be able to stop shouting at each other until the right stops using eliminationist rhetoric, stops wishing violence upon us, and stops using violent framework to sort of frame our national discourse. It's just, it's going to keep being ugly. It's going to keep getting ugly.
Eliminationist? Would you explain that term?
Well, eliminationism, it's actually a term I got out of Daniel Goldhagen's book, Hitler's Milling Executioners, which is a book about how ordinary Jews helped make the Holocaust happen. And I was reading that book at the same time that I was doing research on the anti-Japanese campaign in America that happened between 1900 and 1924, for a book, a historical book I was doing on the Japanese-American internment. And I was struck by the similarities between what he was describing as eliminationist anti-Semitism in Germany prior to the Holocaust, and the sort of the eliminationism that I was seeing in the material that I was researching on the anti-Asian campaign.
I would just add one point there, because I've spoken and interviewed Goldhagen. You know, part of what he argues is how ordinary policemen and other Germans who were not necessarily people who had been, you know, targeted and brainwashed or put into elite units by the Germans, also got into the program, enjoying or at least participating in the genocide.
Willing
way. So it wasn't just Jews that were involved. There were Jewish collaborators. But I think, you know, this was more of an analysis of the Third Reich and how it operated and how, even though you can have an elite that basically is the vanguard of a sort of fascist movement. I write about fascism in my blog today at newsdissector.com/blog. That these fascists essentially affect the entire society. They legitimate the ideas of killing people as necessary, desirable, and the like, even though if the people themselves were not, you know, highly primed or part of these units, they're affected by it. It becomes sort of part of the air they breathe. And this is one of the dangers here about all of this extremist rhetoric, because it reaches people who themselves are not necessarily extremists, but it legitimized these ideas.
Right. Well, that's right. And as I explain in my book, eliminationist rhetoric traditionally has had this very powerful role of giving permission for violent acts, creating permission for people to act out violently, and sometimes, and functionally speaking, in the way I describe it in the book, it's a kind of rhetoric and politics and worldview that doesn't choose to have that believes that the elimination of your opposition is the only desirable outcome. That you're not going to be you're not interested in engaging them in a democratic give and take. You're simply interested in eliminating them. And the politics of eliminationism entails extreme dehumanization, or the rhetoric in particular involves extreme dehumanization, demonization of the opposition. You make them the sort of typical eliminationist rhetoric is where you make people out to be diseases or vermin, things that, you know, you desire to eliminate, things that eliminate.
I was thinking about...
And that was clearly what the Jews did, or they did to the Jews in Germany, but it was also what we did to Native Americans in the 1800s in this country, what we did to African Americans after the Civil War, what we did to Asian Americans in that period between 1900 and 1924 that I talked about. And you still hear a lot of eliminationist rhetoric very much current in our sort of political discourse today.
Jesse Jackson today was talking about another aspect of this that many people don't associate with this, but, you know, the incarceration, mass incarceration of black people throughout the South, where you have like a 30% population in one state, but 75% of the prison population is black. And this is true of many of the states in the so-called Bible Belt across the country, and the people who basically, as a result of this, have been disenfranchised because they're felons. They often get, you know, it's the old kind of crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. The powder cocaine people get off with light sentences. The crack cocaine people are in jail for many more years. The whole spread of the prison complex, the private prisons and the like. You know, people are making money off the pain of these people, but also excluding them, eliminating them in a way as citizens in our country. And this is something that, you know, black leaders seem to be just waking up to really respond to, that this is a policy, this is a practice that's deeply institutionalized in state after state, and it has certain social effects and consequences that really have to be taken seriously.
Yeah, and unfortunately, no one is taking it seriously. You know, right now the conversation seems to be, oh, how mean the liberals were in bringing up the sort of nasty rhetoric that preceded this assassination attempt in Arizona. But in fact, it's pretty much the obvious context for this kind of event, especially if you spend any, you know, if you go down to Arizona right now, it's a pretty ugly place for anybody who's a Democrat to be right now, or anybody, you know, you don't dare reveal yourself as a liberal much to folks, because you never know who's going to verbally, if not physically, assault you for it.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why I think we have to really respect the sheriff who has been outspoken.
Yeah.
You know, last name is what again? Drupnik?
Dubnik.
Clarence Dubnik has been a real hero in this, in my mind, because sheriffs usually just, you know, just give me the facts, ma'am, give me the, you know, and he really offered a perspective, a very human perspective, and one of the things he criticized was, quote, all the crap on radio and TV. And the radio and TV industry came back and said, oh, no, this is completely illegitimate, we're very responsible, et cetera, et cetera. They deny any responsibility in actually broadcasting this, quote, crap. And at least the sheriff had the guts to stand up and talk about this, and he's been a very progressive force there in Tucson. We'll ask our next guest, Sarah, about him and about, you know, the climate in Tucson in a minute. But this is something that's very important. Now, let me close with you, if I can, David, by asking, because we have to take a break now, asking you, how can people read your work? Tell us about Crooks and Liars again as a website that you are the managing editor of.
Crooks and Liars is a website. We actually sort of invented the video blog. John Amato, the proprietor and my boss, is the guy who came up with the idea some years ago of putting videos into a blog. And next thing you knew, it took off. So we specialize in a lot of video. But what we really like to do is show people is expose right-wing nuttery and extremism, and so we run a lot of videos. We talk about but we also talk a lot about these issues, about how extremist rhetoric has a toxic effect on our national discourse.
I would just like
to be
a more thoughtful blog, and folks can pick up my book. You know, I always recommend going to your local bookstore first and just asking them, and they'll order it, and they can usually get it in a couple of days from PolyPoint. And I also have a new book out that I co-wrote with my cohort there, John Amato at Crooks and Liars. The new book is titled Over the Cliff, How Obama's Election Drove the American Right Insane. And in some respects, it's a continuation of the work that I did in The Eliminationists, basically documenting the systematic sort of insanity that's descended upon us from the American right these days, and how we, you know, discusses ways to deal with it.
Well, thanks again, David, for coming back on the program. Certainly agree with you there. I would go a little bit further, calling really for more of a critique of sort of the liberals in the middle here and the right-wing Democrats who are also, including some that we know in the White House, who seem to be on a tremendous avoidance trip here in dealing with the consequences of the financial crisis, appointing
yep.
people like Bill Daley as the new chief of staff in the Congress. I mean, it's not as if the Republican right are the only people to worry about. I know it's fun to take
yeah.
on a Sarah Palin when she seems to be wacky, but I think we have to look closer to home, if you will, and try to hold you know, some of the, quote, Democrats to a higher
yep.
standard. So thanks for being with us.
You bet.
We're
going to
take a break now. We'll be back in a minute on News Dissector Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network.com, 888-874-4888.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and empty shops.
And bankrupt in the AAA. Grandpa loses 401k.
Funda. listening to PRM, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
To PRM, Progressive Radio Network.
It's so fantastic when you use that plastic. Okay, another song from In Debt We Trust. The earlier song is the title song for Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, my new film. You can get more information from Plunder, The Time of Our
Crime of Our Time.
I'm going to get it right, Sherry. Just give me a chance. Try to come back from this embarrassing failure to pronounce the name of my own film properly. I'm going to try again. If not, I'm going to give up totally. Okay, Plunder, thecrimeofourtime.com. There it is. That's the website to check out. Sherry, introduce our next guest, if you will.
I would be happy to. Sarah Spice grew up in Tucson, attended the University of Arizona. She has chosen to become an activist and is now expert in conflict resolution, peace building, and has been focused on the public discussion of social injustices, human rights struggles in the Arizona-Mexican border region, which is fueling a lot of the anger in Arizona. And she has contributed her expertise in economics and peace building globally to form a growing grassroots organization called Desert Bridges, which brings her focus back to Arizona. So, Sarah, welcome to News Dissector Radio. Why don't you tell us about what happened in Tucson following what was the people's reaction? What's going on? What's the temperature, the climate in your town?
Largely inspired by Sheriff Dupnik's statements, there has really been a systematic identification and exposure of sources of hate speech within our community. And it's important to note, because events like this can go multiple directions. Had this become a Second Amendment issue, the polarization amongst Arizonans could have been a lot more significant. And what we're seeing now really is a consensus being built on the collective rejection of hateful messages, who's putting them out, and the businesses that are supporting them. The funeral of Christina Taylor Greene really showed us something that we haven't seen before here in Arizona. I mean, Hell's Angels came out, Cowboys, Children, Hispanic, Tucson Islamic groups, and we're really seeing a form of consensus out of rejection of something which is new. That said, however, it's interesting to see, listening to David Nywert and the idea of elimination, it's interesting to see how there is really a going after of who is putting those messages out that is fueled by a lot of anger, and it's not a nonviolent feeling that is the response here in the community.
Well, as a side note about the funeral,
mm-hmm.
her parents chose to donate all her organs, and they've already saved the life of another child. I think that bespeaks volumes about the good side of people in general, not just in Arizona.
Very much. She has been and will continue to be such an inspiration for so many people. And that the parents chose to have, you know, her organs donated is just unbelievable. And everybody has been so touched by her.
So what is Building Bridges?
Building Bridges is, at large, an attempt to build consensus. We are lucky here in Southern Arizona to have a large group of peace activism, people active in peace activism. That said, however, peace activism, by definition, one could argue, can be exclusive. And people have been debating about this issue of border security and immigration reform and core principles of peace activism can be perceived to alienate groups right away. So Desert Bridges really is focused on bringing people into a room, and Danny mentioned the words, you know, demonize and delegitimize other people, and really tell human stories and build bridges on the mutual consensus that with our border security issue and our immigration issue, we have families that are touched and we have children that are touched on all sides, and humanizing the other party and building consensus out of wanting to embrace realistic solutions.
Danny, have you ever done anything with 2020 or in your journalistic career about border immigration?
No, I didn't do border immigration so much, but I have done a film about building consensus, peaceful coexistence and conflict resolution in the Middle East, where, you know, various young people from Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Egypt, and the neighboring countries got together to talk about what they had in common, how to build a discussion that didn't just break down on, quote, the facts as each side understood them, but actually the need for humanity to transcend some of these, quote, so-called facts and recognize the humanity in the people who they basically feared or hated. And, you know, it's called Seeds of Peace. This was a program in the Middle East that's a very successful one of youth outreach. And, you know, I think we have a situation here where if it wasn't for the shooting of a congresswoman that made this such a national story, an event like this might have happened and been sort of dismissed as just a local aberration. But because Gabby Giffords was involved, because this got so much national attention, that the president spoke on it and all the rest of it, I think has forced a lot of different communities and individuals to respond to this, not just in a negative, hostile way, but to really try to find ways to work together to understand the pain of the different people involved, particularly the parents of this young child, but also, you know, the congresswoman, you know, who herself carried a Glock, but, you know, married to an astronaut. I mean, it could happen to anyone. And, you know, a lot of it is like just because of the people who happen to be there at the time. So this is a learning, living learning situation. And the fact that people in Arizona are been open to talking about all of this, you know, is very important, because there are so few ways to build community dialogues. Everybody is sort of trapped in the private issues of their lives, their pain, their problems. You know, we are all wearing, you know, earphones, listening to iPods, you know, our iPhones or you know, basically our music technologies, not really talking to anybody, just in our own little worlds. And when something like this happens, our worlds, you know, sort of our private worlds become a public world. And I think that's what, you know, attracts me to Sarah's work and the work of other people there who are trying to tease out of this experience, a chance for people to meet each other and talk about what's going on. So you're saying, Sarah, that there has been a positive response to this in that respect.
Amazingly so. I mean, for an area that has been previously so polarized on issues of border security and human rights discourse, we have seen those groups that are really hard to bring to a consensus all really moving forward and wanting to embrace a more peaceful community. And it has been profound. It's truly been profound to see.
You know, the media sometimes misses the texture mm-hmm. of all of this. You know, they want to put everything into categories and little boxes and what have you, and treat it all in this. They don't see a sense of a flow here of people really learning from each other or talking to each other in a way, transcending maybe some of their political certainties to try to cope with a human tragedy of a family that lost a child, of other people who have died, the heroism of a young gay man who basically went to the congresswoman's side while she was under fire. I mean, there's a lot of dramatic aspects of this that really brings out the best in humanity as well as the worst.
Absolutely. And in all of this, it's really interesting because sometimes I step back and ask myself, how would we have brought these groups together? It's this event is so sad and so unfortunate, and yet it represents such a spark of hope, of community dialogue, humanizing other parties, acknowledgement that we are all sharing this situation, and we are all sharing the tension that we live with, and we are all sharing the fear that is due to a great degree of polarization in our community, and that we all carry it as individuals, and to see the larger community discuss these issues and out in the open is truly miraculous.
888-874-4888. If you want to join the conversation here on News Dissector Radio on Progressive Radio Network .com. You know, what's interesting also was the reaction to President Obama's speech. You know, everybody initially, the John Stewart captured this the other night, you know, everybody initially in the media basically saying, oh, it was a really good speech. Then they started picking it apart, you know. He didn't say this, he didn't say that. What did you think of it?
I thought it was extremely inspirational. I thought his speech was very important for Arizona to have him come, also so close to Martin Luther King's birthday. Such a pivotal time. I don't know if this was well publicized in the national media. McHale Center fits 11,000 people, and the event was to start at 6 p.m. and by noon, something like 18,000 people stood in line. It was just amazing.
People wanted to participate. Let's not forget that Arizona was one of the last states to endorse the Martin Luther King birthday and opposed it, you know, viciously. And there's always been a very hard line right wing, you know, tradition in Arizona going back to Barry Goldwater. John McCain on alternate Tuesdays is either really on the right or he's a maverick, depending on what he has for breakfast. I mean, but it does seem as if this issue sort of overshadowed the meanness of the immigration laws there and the controversies with these sheriffs and what have you, and showed a side of things that we really hadn't seen before. An outspoken sheriff, for example, young people, the kids in her school, you know, how they coped with this. I mean, it was very, very, very moving, I must say. And, you know, as somebody who has a daughter and thinks about this also in personal terms, you know, this is shocking. It could happen to anyone if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. So, you know, why we have to really learn lessons from this is so important. And, you know, the media will move on. It's been the hot story of the week. But now, you know, it's on to the next divisive event.
Keeping an eye on the clock, I have a quick question for Sarah before
you have to wrap up.
Is Sarah, very briefly, tell us about how Desert Bridges focuses on respect for diversity and human rights, and how do you support that and grow it? What can people do?
Well, really, it's about acknowledging that universal human rights is a profoundly American value, and that that and nonviolence are two things we can all get behind. We, very much like President Obama mentioned in his speech, we will not all agree. We will not all agree on the same solutions, but we can all agree that solutions need to come by certain terms. And Desert Bridges really tries to build consensus on that, bringing multiple people in a room, humanizing the other party, and on the other hand, also really honoring the family-friendly campaigns and building on those things that make us all Tucsonans or Southern Arizonans. And
excuse me, Sarah, is there a website or is there a contact number if people want to find out more?
There will be information up shortly. It's really building at the moment, so I will make sure I will forward that to you.
Okay, well, we'll have to announce that next week. But
thank
Desert
you.
Bridges is certainly an organization to pay attention to and pay respect to. I want to thank also your brother Michael for helping connect me to the work that you're doing, because it is clearly of broader interest, and it's something that, you know, I wish you the best with. And thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your concerns and your work. Sherry, you did good in basically insisting that we have Sarah on despite any reservations that I might have out of total ignorance, and I'm pleased about that. I just want to thank everybody for listening. If you want to get in touch with me, you can write to dissector@mediachannel.org. We're going to post the podcast of this particular show up on my blog at newsdissector.com/blog as soon as the folks at PRN get it to us. We will have that up so you can listen to the show, and if you want to, share it with any friends. Mediachannel.org is a media issues network that I edit that's in the process of being rehabilitated and reborn as a website. It started in 2000, 1999, actually. It's been around for a long time. We've had a lot of great links and great broken links. So we're going to try to fix that in the weeks and months ahead. We really want your support and your involvement. My film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, is available on the website, plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. Progressive Radio Network has its own website with the podcasts or other shows as well. This show is also, by the way, on iTunes, so you'll be able to listen to it, hopefully tell your friends about it if you find what we're doing of value. We just want to pay tribute to a arts activist pioneer here in New York who just died at age 91, Ellen Stewart, the founder of the La Mama Experimental Theater Club in the Lower East Side in the East Village, was a trailblazer of off-Broadway shows. And I want to just acknowledge with respect her contribution to creating a political culture where all ideas can be heard, where creativity and inspiration can be encouraged. That's something we certainly need. We need it here on the radio. We need it in television. We need it in our lives to nurture us. And Ellen was one of many arts people who contributed to that. Sherry Welch, thank you for joining the show today. And Sherry will be on in the weeks ahead. And please, if you have suggestions, guests, ideas, please get in touch. Just one last thing. We're appealing for any potential interns who might want to work with us on the show and the other work that we do. You can write to me again at danny@mediachannel.org if you want more information or if you want to help out in some way. We need some people with some skills and some dedication and a little bit of time to contribute. So please think about that as well. We'll be going out now. I want to thank Matt, we want to thank Carol Lee, we want to thank everybody who helped with the show here at PRN. Until next week, I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a
40% of the station carried no news of the world.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message, wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, buying coke, buying Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
and experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say. We don't have anything to do.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit. Slim slam diagram, data jam, handicap caught it. Yo, you bought it. My mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby? Got news, good.
What we need to know.
News, good.
What we want to know.
News, good.
What we think we know.
Till freedom is a rumor.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson abandoned babies.
Order now.
So is the news of the people left out. Put a camera in my face just to hear me shout. But they don't want to hear what I shout about. You love a whim or cup, but not a people rebuff. We never play the lead in the sitcom you